I still don't like hugging. My name's Tom, and I am an alcoholic. My home group is the We Care Group in Lake Placid, Florida, and my sobriety date is June 6, 2010. It has been quite a while since I spoke. I've had a couple of years of pretty intense life changes, and so I've sort of backed off from speaking. So this is the first time in a couple of years, so I'm a little rusty, but we'll see what God gives us today. Not quite sure what we're going to get. I knew from a very young age that there was something different from me. I didn't feel like I fit in with the rest of the world. My mother used to tell me that I was the most miserable five-year-old that she had ever met. And, you know, which was true, but wherever I went, whatever I did, I just felt like I was on the outside looking in, as far back as I can remember. And when I was a kid, I ended up very much into comics, and there was one comic that I could identify with more than anything else, and that was Superman. Because here was this character who desperately wanted to be accepted by the society that he lived in. And that was me. And I could get that. I could get that duality that he had going, trying to figure out where Clark Kent began and where Superman ended and where, you know, and how that all was going to go together. And I got that. And so I became very much... that sort of became an addiction for me, I guess. But it was a safe place for me, and I got a lot of strength out of that when I was a kid, because that was the first thing I could really identify with. Growing up, there was a second phase of that whole Clark Kent thing that I could identify with, because I grew up in a newspapering family. I think I'm fourth generation now. Fourth generation newspaper man. So that was another thing I could sort of identify with that character. But I could remember I was about six or seven, and my mother and my grandmother loaded me up, and we went out to Lake Placid. They were going to go cover a wreck. And I can remember getting the speech from my grandmother on the way down there that if I was ever to do this job, I had to be cold as steel. I remember her saying that, I had to be cold as steel. I had to find a way of not having the emotions, of not showing those emotions, of being stoic. Or she said I would never be able to do it. And that sort of rang with me. And we get down there, and it's raining, and lots of flashing lights. Really, I'd never been to anything like that before. And my mother's out, and she's talking to the trooper, and my grandmother's getting her camera out, and she's setting it up. And next thing I know, there's a volunteer fireman coming over, and he lifts me up and puts me on top of my grandmother's car, and she hands me these flashes to hold, and she starts taking pictures. And in between the flashes, I could see mangled car sheets and stuff, and really didn't understand what was going on. And she changes her roll of film, and I'm still up there, and she starts taking a new set of pictures. And by this time, they had removed the sheet from the car. And so that was, you know, that was my first exposure to, you know, that sort of a fatality, that sort of tragedy. And I was six or seven, and all that I can remember was I'm not allowed to feel anything. And I had to find a way to not feel anything. And that started off a trend for me. And there is a lot of ways that I attempted to do that before... I finally found alcohol. It was food for a while. And when I got tired of the consequences with food, it was exercise, and then it was sex, and it was anything and everything. And then finally, when I was 18, I was at Florida State, and it was my 18th birthday, as a matter of fact, and never had a cigarette at that point, never had a drink, never anything else. And, you know, I ended up doing all of that that night. And it was this magical thing. I mean, the second I took that alcohol into my mouth, something happened in me. There was this magical little click, and I had found the thing that was going to shut off those feelings and those emotions and that spinning head. And I didn't care about the rest of the world at that point. I had finally found what I had been searching for. And I was off and running, and I wouldn't stop drinking for another, I wouldn't stop drinking for another 10 years. But I escalated very quickly. You know, I was, within 3 months, I was a daily drinker, and there was no stopping. And very quickly finding consequences, particularly if I was drinking with other people, the consequences would be pretty quick. I remember we had a home football game, and I was there on a partial academic, partial sports scholarship, and staying in sports dorms. And we all decided to go paint ourselves up in this garnet and gold body paint and wear nothing but boxer shorts, and just, it was crazy. But somewhere along the line, we decided it would be a good idea to liberate a horse and from its captivity. And made perfect sense at the time. So we were taking turns riding this liberated horse through the Capitol before the Capitol Police caught up with us. And I guess it was lucky for me and my roommate that we were so drunk at this point that we had staggered way behind this little parade. And the poor guy that was actually on the horse got into some trouble, and the rest of us just got carted back to campus and told to stop drinking, which was fine for everybody else, but not for me, because I couldn't do that. Because I was at a point where if I did, my mind would spin out of control. And all of those emotions that I had been stuffing and all of those memories that I didn't want to deal with started coming back up. And I knew that that was different, and I knew that there was something wrong about that, but I really didn't care. I just didn't want to feel, so I did whatever I needed to do to continue not to feel, to continue to get to that magical little place. And there was a whole lot of life going on for me at that point. About a month prior, the girlfriend that I had at the time and I lost our son to SIDS. And we had been through weeks upon weeks upon weeks upon weeks of interviews with investigators and detectives and this person and that person. And so all of this was overlapping. And the second I would sober up, all of that would come back to me. And I just could not, I would not let myself deal with it. And we ran out of alcohol when we got back to campus that night. And that was not a good thing. That was all coming back, and I did whatever I could to find some sort of an escape, and I did. Ended up in some sort of a stupid, I really don't know still completely how it happened, but somehow I decided in some sort of euphoric trance, I guess, that it would be a good idea to kiss my roommate. Not really a good idea. No. He didn't like that too much. And I ended up getting quite a beating out of that, which sobered me up pretty good, and everything started flowing back. You know, my son and all of these feelings that had built up, and I just didn't know what to do. And I ended up on a bridge looking down on I-10, knowing that that jumping would be my only way out. I knew it. If I was going to shut it off, that was going to be it. And I eventually was able to rationalize myself down to, okay, well, you have been drinking beer, so that must be the problem. If you don't drink any more beer, you're going to be okay. So I'm like, okay, we can do that. We'll switch to liquor. And you're drinking with other people. If you eliminate the other people, you're going to be golden. Because if there's nobody else around, there can't be any consequences. And it made perfect sense at the time. And so, you know, with a couple more rationalizations, I was able to step back from that bridge. But I can count on one hand the number of times that I drank with anybody else after that point. I became a solo act because I was absolutely convinced that there would be trouble if I drank with other people. And so I became very, very isolated. And we fast forward to, you know, through college and getting I got my bachelor's, got my master's, and I'm working by this point, and I seem to be failing upwards. No matter how much I drink, I just am failing upwards in the industry, and didn't 100% make much sense to me, but that's what was happening. And I got the sense that I was not touchable, that I had finally found the magic little recipe where I wouldn't have consequences. But I didn't realize how much I was losing myself in this process, because I was just absolutely miserable all the time. I could not live without a drink. And there was this very magic level that I needed. If I went past it, I couldn't function. If I didn't go far enough with the drinking, my mind would spin out of control. And I kept having to take more and more desperate measures. I was so, so paranoid that somebody would find out about how I was drinking and everything that was going on in my life, that I would drive, you know, to the next county over to buy all of my liquor. And I thought I had a pretty good system. I thought nobody really knew. And, you know, things were escalating. And, you know, one day I got called to the chief of police's office, who was a pretty good friend of mine. And, you know, I sit down across from him at his desk, and I pull out my notebook, and I have my pen there, and I'm ready to write this story. And he starts telling me about me. And he knew, like, every little detail of my life at that point. And my mind about exploded. I mean, how could he possibly know? But he did. He knew every store that I was going to, every place that I went. He knew it all. And he told me that, essentially, that I was going to go to treatment or I wouldn't like the consequences. And when the chief of police tells you to go to treatment, you jump. After a two-week drunk. And so I did. And it was a very strange experience going into treatment. I was so ignorant of anything recovery oriented at that point that I didn't know. I really didn't even know AA existed. You know, as connected into the communities that I worked in, I didn't even know this existed. And I didn't know that people like me typically go to detox before going to treatment. I didn't. I was just an idiot. And so I ended up going to Port St. Lucie to this treatment center. And we get there, and they load us in. I was there maybe 20 minutes, and they load us in this big white bus, and there's all these Yankees there from New Jersey, and they're talking funny. And I wasn't sure if I was in hell or not, but it could have been. And they took us, you know, really no explanation. They took us over to this candlelight meeting in Palm Bay. And middle of summer, the air conditioning was broken, and they had wooden folding chairs. I don't know if any of y'all recall wooden church folding chairs, but they're very, very uncomfortable, particularly as if when you were as sick as I was at that point, and it was miserable. And the best I can recall the topic that night, they were talking about higher powers. But what the meeting devolved into was this knockdown, drag out about whose higher power was the best. And you had this faction over here arguing for that one, and that faction over there arguing for that one. And there was a couple of interesting people in the back saying that Satan was their higher power. And I'm sitting there, my first exposure to AA ever, and I thought that that was AA's message. And I knew if I had to believe any of those things that they were, that I was hearing, or I thought I was hearing at that meeting, I could have been hallucinating, I don't know, that AA wouldn't work. I knew those things that they were talking about, what I heard that night, wouldn't work for me. So that just became a 28-day vacation, essentially. I went through the motions, and after 28 days, I got out, and work required me to go to meetings, and so I went to meetings, and I did what was required of me. I did not get involved. I sat in the back. I was disruptive. I was an excellent example of what not to do. I think I managed about 9 months before I went absolutely nuts. And I am just spinning out at that point. And it wasn't that I was fearful of using again. It wasn't that I was fearful of dying. It wasn't any of that. I was fearful of losing the job. That was the only thing that was scaring me at that point, is if I screw this up, I'm going to screw up the job, because that was the most important thing to me. That was the alpha and omega in my life. If I had that, everything else would be okay. You know, because I could hide behind that mask. I like masks, and that was one of the ones that I could hide behind. Because I could dress up and I could put on my slacks and the shirt and put on a tie, and everybody was going to think I was okay, as long as I had that. And I went absolutely crazy. I was back at a point where I didn't want to live anymore. And out of desperation, I started calling around, and I could not get anybody to take my call at that point. I was living back over here, back at work at this point, and actually going to meetings here in Polk County. And I'm calling around, and I couldn't get anybody, and the ones that I would get a hold of that I'd never talked to before said meet them at a meeting, and I knew a meeting was the last thing I needed. And finally, I got a hold of this guy that was willing at least to talk to me. And so I met him, and he said that I don't think you need to be alone at this point. And I sort of agreed with that, because I didn't know what I was going to do. And so we ended up going, he's like, well, you can come over for a while to my place, and we'll figure stuff out. And I went over there, and it was in this RV park. And I think I knew pretty instantly that something was off about that place. Didn't know quite what it was. but it was off. I just couldn't place it. But I wrote it off because I'm, you know, I'm sort of crazy at this point, so I'm self-doubting. And we go inside, and he gives me a piece of paper, and we're making this little master plan of his of what I'm going to do over the next couple of days, and I'm going through the motions again. I'm just sort of glad not to be physically alone at that point. And I can't sleep, and I can't sleep. I am just going absolutely crazy. My mind is in 1,000 directions at once. And I, about 1:30-ish in the morning, he got back up, and, you know, I'm there on the couch. And he brings out, he has these, brings out these two pills that I didn't recognize, never had seen before. I sort of had assumed that they were some sort of a benzo. And that was going to at least help take the edge off. And this guy said it was okay, and he's in AA, so that must be right. And, you know, so I ended up taking these, and that was pretty much the last thing I remember. He had Law and Order playing on his TV over and over again, episode after episode, and the last thing I remember is that damn theme song. And I awoke... I awoke about 12 hours later, and my pants were down, and I knew what had happened at that point. I had known what had happened at that point, and I just absolutely wanted to kill him, absolutely wanted to kill myself, and didn't have the courage to do either. I just did not want to go on. And I somehow ended up getting back to my car and just driving and driving and driving and driving at that point. And I ended up in Orlando, where I spent the next 3 months doing whatever it took to not feel anything and everything it took. Literally working a corner most of that time. Sometimes I would have my car, usually not. I would have it rented out for whatever purpose. You know, living in this alleyway, and that was my life. And I would, I have such gutter bravado. I would go, I had two very nice outfits with me and the leather shoes, and I was just absolutely convinced everybody would still think that I was okay if I could get into the, you know, check out the key to the side bathroom at the gas station and wash these every day, and then I would still be okay. It was just absolutely insane. And, but that's what I did. And I would wake up every morning, every morning, and it would just be so devastating because I knew I had another day of going and out there and doing what I was doing to try to find enough just to end it, because that's what I was trying to do. I knew I was too much of a coward to do it myself, but if I, you know, if I found a way to take too much and not wake up, that would be okay. All these rationalizations, and that was my goal, and it never worked. No matter how much I tried, no matter what I did, I just couldn't die. And I got to a point where I was escalating the type of people that I was soliciting at that point, trying to pick up dangerous people. Maybe they could do me in. That would work. And my very last day out there, that about happened. I had solicited the wrong two people, and it was a bloody nasty beatdown. I mean, there is no way that I should have survived that, and I didn't want to going in. Lost all of my teeth on that upper side, all of my teeth on this lower side, still gone from that. And in the middle of all that, I don't even know where I don't remember praying out. I really don't. I've thought about it and thought about it. I don't remember praying, but I do remember the thought that popped into my head that somewhere towards the end of that, I had just that thought that I wanted to live. It wasn't a prayer, just a thought. And that was enough because what was happening that day stopped. Something scared them off, and I don't know what it was, but it stopped. And, you know, luckily it was a day that I didn't have my car rented out. And I got in the car, and I drove. And, you know, these strange twists of fate, I ended up in Port St. Lucie again. And I ended up staying and getting sober there. And I was absolutely a wreck coming in. I sold off the car, was living under a bridge on US 1 and going to any and every meeting I could possibly find. And that's when I met Tracy for the first time, actually. She doesn't remember it, but I remember her because she was one of the first people that I could remember hearing hope from, one of the only people I could hear hope from when I would go to the alternative meetings over there. And I just kept coming back, going to every meeting, but I couldn't function. I knew that it, being at a meeting was the one safe place for me. It was the one place that I felt like the world couldn't get me. But I couldn't talk to anybody. I couldn't function. I would run. I would break out in shakes and sweats if anybody tried to talk to me. It was pretty miserable. And there was one meeting more than any other where I really felt safe, and it was this Friday night men's meeting. And these guys there, they still scare the hell out of me. And crotchety bastards, too. I tell you what. But they kept talking about how people needed a big book, and I just could not, as much as I was trying to put every, you know, doing whatever I needed to do to do legitimate work at this point, to try to survive, I could not justify buying a big book, so I stole one. And I thought I was so sly, and I was from the men's meeting, and three of them corner me after the meeting, and they literally backed me into a corner and assigned me my first sponsor, who happened to be the crotchetiest, I thought, of them all, also from New Jersey with that damn accent crap. And I still, yeah, this is, still have that big book, by the way. And he became my first sponsor. And it was very, very slow progress for me. But I was so desperate at that point that I did anything and everything that man told me to do. But I was still fighting. It wasn't... At that point, I'm not even sure that I had a desire not to drink, but I had a desire to live. And that was enough for me to keep coming back. And we started going through readings and, you know, the bare bones of some step work. And I kept coming back and talking to him every day and doing everything he told me. And we're getting into the steps, hot and heavy, but I could not... I could not wrap my head around step two. Could not, because there was no hope. This was never going to get any better. I felt that I was so damaged at that point that there could be no recovery. And I was so violently angry at that point. My issues with a lot of the stuff that I put myself through manifested in, I had this vile hatred for anybody that was gay. Vile. And just, it was nasty. And I couldn't get over it. Couldn't. And I remember I was in a particularly bad spot, and I called up that sponsor, and he said, okay, I'm going to pick you up, and we're going to go to this meeting. And he didn't tell me which meeting it was going into any of this, but it was on a Thursday, and the only meeting at that time was a Gays in Recovery meeting. And he told me on the way there, and I was so pissed, and I tried to jump out of the van. And I get there. I stuck with it, and I get there. And it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life, because I was there with these people that I did not think deserved at this point to breathe the same air as me. And the meeting opens up, and it's my turn to share, and it all came out. I mean, just everything that had been built up in me. It was the first time that I had gotten honest about anything. You know, I had the willingness to keep coming back, but I had nothing else at that point. And I had finally gotten that little bit of honesty at that meeting. And by the time that I got done sharing and it was everybody else's turn, I remember this woman shared that she had always, she had come to realize that the insanity in her life had always been the belief that God wanted her to be unhappy. And there it was. There it was from this person that I didn't think deserved to breathe, sharing a magical little phrase that explained everything that I couldn't ever figure out before. See, that's what I could never put words to my entire life. I believed that whatever was out there wanted me to be unhappy. And here this woman was sharing it. And it was just this moment. I can remember, I can tell you where each of them were sitting. I can tell you what they're wearing, particularly their shoes. I was very good at shoes at that point. And, you know, and leaving that meeting, everything seemed brighter. Everything seemed lighter. And I knew that, you know, I knew that I wanted this at that point. I couldn't fully wrap my head 100% around step three, but I wanted, you know, I had the willingness to try the rest of the steps, and that's what got me through step three the first time, was, okay, I want what these people have at this point. I can see it, I can feel it, I'm aware of this hope, and I want it, and I want this change, and that got me, it was a decision to work the rest of the steps. Which was a pretty miserable process. Particularly step four, I think I went through 5 drafts before I got one that was acceptable. Because, you know, here I am, I'm a professional writer. I can write my way in or out of anything. My sponsor didn't like that. And finally, you know, it was this very delicate balancing act he had with me, that he would get me to a point that he had to get me to this point where I was angry, for I could, almost to the point of rage, that I could connect with some of the emotions that I kept trying to, going back to having to be cold as steel, I could write them out of a fourth step. I could write anything out of it. And he would get me to this point where I just had no other choice but to be honest. And one of the tools was, he even had me switch hands. Instead of writing it out on right-handed, he would have me switch and do it with my left hand, and that worked too. And we would get through this. And when we sat down to do that first fifth step, that was an experience too, because I had no problem talking about any of it up to the fears, because I had no fears that I was willing to, you know, admit to. You know, that would go against any identity I had at that point, because I had to be that cold as steel individual, and he had to push me and push me and push me until I could finally do that. And I had no relief going through that first fifth step. There was no instant relief. I was still miserable. And I didn't start to get better until I started to get into some of the solutions that he was giving me. And one of them was He had a whole slew. But the one that I thought was absolutely going to kill me dead was he told me that I had to start greeting at the men's meeting. Because I was so terrified of anybody else. Everybody was going to hurt me at that point, particularly men. And, you know, it's my home group at the time, but I can't even shake any of their hands. I'm so scared of them. You know, it was this weird cycle that I was stuck in. And he told me that that was one of the immediate plans of action that we were going to get into. And I told him I didn't think that was going to work. And he said I didn't have much choice. So I went, and part of it was that I had to raise my hand at that meeting and speak for the first time and tell them where I was at and what his suggestion was, and let it go from there. And I did that. And this old timer shared his experience, which was so eerily similar to mine, down to the month of sobriety I had at that point, shared that his sponsor made him do the exact same thing. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to get out of this greeting thing now. And so I did. And I showed up that next Friday, and I'm out there deer in the headlights. I'm shaking, I'm trembling, I'm sweating. I think my heart feels like it's about to jump out of my chest, but I wouldn't ask for any help with this. My sponsor's gone inside, and I wouldn't ask for help. And this regular at the meeting came up, who wasn't there the week before, and he started talking to me, not about recovery, just about life, just standing by me and talking to me. And I got through that. I got through shaking these hands and talking to these men, and I'm facing this fear, and I've got this help by my side. And it was the first time that I realized that I never had to be alone again. And that was another powerful turning point for me. Down the road a little bit, my life has taken a lot of turns. And at a year and a half sober, I had to turn myself into jail for a year. My consequences had finally caught up, and I was sentenced to 364 days, which I did a little over 9 months on. And I thought I was really good at this point. I had been through the steps and was going through the steps again and felt very grounded and, you know, involved in doing service work and this, that, and the other. I'm good. Not so good once those gates closed behind me. I realized I might have skimped a little bit on this higher power thing. And it was a very rough transition. At that point, you know, we were sort of at a low point with our corrections committee in that area. We went almost 4 months without a meeting being brought into that jail. And it was an absolute fight to eventually get a big book. But when I finally did, what got me through that was, okay, I had a dedicated time in that cell that I was going to do, be reading out of the big book. And that eventually caught fire. There were times that we would have more than a dozen people crammed into that little old cell, going through the big book every day. And that got me through that process because, you know, even, you know, early on in that experience, I was ready to, I had it all planned out on how I was going to end it in there. And one of the voices of, you know, in the voice of one of those crotchety men from that meeting, I could hear plain as day in my head tell me that you know what the solution is and it's being of service. And that's what stopped that from happening. And I could hear it. I can still hear it. And that's what got me through that. We did those meetings and got through that, and getting out. And being in Highlands County at this point, I was chairing, it was funny, I was chairing a meeting, and a young people's meeting, and it was sort of on its end legs. It had, it had ran its usefulness, and I was the only one there, and I was about to shut up, and somebody that I had encountered several times when I was out there rocking and rolling and owed an amends to showed up. And it was Robbie, as a matter of fact. Because Robbie and I would go toe-to-toe when I was out there rocking and rolling. We didn't like each other very much. He was the postmaster then, and I was running the newspaper, and we would fight. We would fight. And I owed him some pretty serious, I was pretty nasty, and I owed him some serious amends, and he walked into the meeting I was chairing, and I was the only one there, so we had a... Robbie has this amazing way of walking into my life exactly when I needed him, and that was one of those things. And he walked out for a little bit. Then Jason got sober. Jason here got sober, and his dad started going to different meetings to give Jason some breathing room. And Robbie ended up in my life again, but he ended up in my life again at a point where I was the most desperate. I think I was more desperate even when I was getting sober, because all of the truths that I had learned about myself when I was over on the coast, I abandoned when I moved here. I didn't feel safe anymore being me. And a lot of the things that I had come to understand about me, the things that I couldn't change, that were just who I was, I pretended didn't exist. I went back into that mask mode when I lived here. And I had known for months that it was killing me. It was just eating me. I knew that I had to start getting honest, and I knew I had to take that next step, that I needed to really start living who I was, and I couldn't do it. It would come up every night. I would take an inventory, and it would come up every night. And I was so miserable. And around Christmas that year, it was actually Christmas Day. I was so desperate. I went to an Alcathon, and I hate Alcathons because they're too social, and there's people, and they're happy. But they give me, it ended up being an 11-step meeting, and they give me the 11-step prayer to read, and I couldn't get two words into it without bawling, because I knew what I had to do. I knew I had to take these steps into honesty. And, by this point, I had pushed everybody away. I'm dealing with this on my own because I didn't think I could trust my support system. I didn't think I could trust my sponsor with it. I was dealing with this on my own, and I made a lot of right decisions, some of them ill-timed. But I made, I did what I needed to do to become honest with myself, and it wasn't particularly as well-received as I thought it would be in my head. And... but I did it. At least I had gotten honest, and it started this change. And I was pretty desperate because there was meetings I was suddenly no longer welcomed at because of who I was. Men's meetings said I was no longer welcome there that I had joined. There's a lot of things. The sponsor I had just could not handle this truth about me. And I found Robbie again. Robbie found me again. And we ended up at this meeting, and it was all because Jason came in, that Robbie was going to different meetings, and Robbie said, "You need to come to the lake." And he introduced me to people like Damien, and Damien shared his story with me. And it was the first time that I had ever heard anybody tell my story before, was when he did that over the phone. And, that was a couple of years ago, and it's been a pretty intense learning curve ever since. But every day that has gone by since then has been absolutely amazing. You know, I have had ups and I have had downs, but I have stayed sober. And I feel loved for the very first time in my entire life. And it's amazing thinking to like people that have always been there. They keep coming back, like Tracy and Carrie and Bubba and Linda. All these people that have always been like people have always been in my life, and I didn't even know the connection until Robbie brought me up here. You know, Miss L, who's not here today, even, I guess she's taken a mild interest in me, I don't know. You know, she commanded that I was even going to do step work with her, so I, you know, this place has given me the opportunity to do step work with a past trustee, which is absolutely amazing. And I have everything I want today. You know, I am absolutely content. And I'll tell you one thing that I have found. I've sort of skimped on talking about service, and I'm trying to rush because Karen's looking at me funny. And but, you know, I have found that there is life, you know, life outside of AA can include service too, because I have found service in AA and I have found service outside of AA. And one of the biggest things changing my life and finding who I am is being involved at the theater now. It has taught me more about character defects inside of myself and in others. Finding characters on the stage than I ever thought possible. And I know it is very outside of the box, but I highly, if you're ever struggling with step 6 and 7, get involved with your community theater and get a part. Because finding the character that you have to play will help you learn about the defects inside of me. I have played mean, nasty, drunk. They've cast me as a drunk a lot. But I have played... You know, I've had to find elements that I didn't know were inside of me that were always there. So that has been truly an eye-opening experience, and it would never have happened if I hadn't come to the lake. So I'm gonna shut up now because I'm blabbering, and I'm crying, and that I don't like either. But thank you for letting me share.